Thank you very much for coming. It's my great pleasure today to introduce Dr. Matthew Belmonte, who's going to do our developmental seminar. So Matthew's had a very interesting background, which he's happy for me to share with you. So basically, Matthew, as he, in his own words, grew up in the shadow of a mother with autism. And hence, that I think has fueled a lot of his research interests, and we're going to hear about some of that today. In terms of academic trajectory, so Matthew, just talk about, this is the first time I've heard this, that he was kicked out of graduate school at UCSD. So I thought that's kind of an inspirational story for you guys in your highs and lows of graduate school, that it can all turn out good. And then he was welcomed by Boston University. Well, he started off, actually, his undergraduate was in computer science and English literature in Cornell, and then he went to UCSD to do neuroscience, got kicked out of there, was welcomed by Boston University, where he finished his neuroscience graduate school, and then had postdoc experience working in Cambridge in the UK with Simon Baron Cohen, and has academic positions in Cornell University, and in India, and now in the UK at Nottingham Trent University, where he's currently working. So I have been following Matthew's work since I was a PhD student myself, and personally have been really inspired by a lot of the work that Matthew has done. I met him at a conference when I was doing my PhD, and this isn't honestly true. It was a conversation I had with Matthew that kind of really shifted the direction of my EEG research and has led to what I feel is a lot of the success that I've had in my own work today. So I do really, we don't know each other particularly well, but I always remember that conversation the first time I met him. It kind of really kick-started a direction in my research, which I've been very grateful for. So it's my very great pleasure to introduce him today, and I hope you all enjoy his talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Liz. It's, I think, one of the ways that we can all really succeed is not even so much in the work that we do ourselves, but in the influence we have over good people who do great work. So that's a very nice story. It's great to be back here at Sheffield. I've visited a few times now for various reasons, and I always love coming to this city and this university. I want to tell you about partially some recent work that we've done, and partially some new work that is on the horizon, some plans. And I want to give this talk from the perspective of intervening in autism through what might seem at first glance an unconventional route. Let me get into it. Three parts. First, I want to tell you a bit of theoretical neurobiological background about autism that feeds into the therapeutic work that I'm going to discuss, particularly on abnormalities of brain connectivity in autism. And then I want to tell you about some work that we've done on the relationship between social cognition and some more domain general cognitive skills from which social cognition may emerge in part. And then in the third part, which is the forward-looking bit of the talk, I want to tell you about some therapeutic imperatives and a therapeutic system that we've been working on recently. So part number one, I want to tell you about disconnected, or actually I think now the field has really moved to the notion of DYS, connected brain and cognition. So back in, anybody who knows autism knows this slide, but back in 2004 we published a couple of papers that had a fairly significant influence on the field, talking about the roots of autism in local overconnectivity in local neural assemblies, and how that local overconnectivity might lead to patterns of disconnection, a failure to develop appropriate long-range functional connectivities between widely separated brain regions. Since that time, I think that that view has been refined from simple disconnection to more to abnormal connectivity, abnormal patterns of connectivity amongst brain regions by the work of a number of people, principally Axel Mueller in San Diego. But anybody who knows autism knows this so-called triad of impairments by which autism is diagnosed. This has been in the books since the word go, and the notion is that you look for a triad of impairments in social function, communicative function, and a kind of cognitive inflexibility that manifests in restricted and repetitive patterns of behavior. Now, those elements of the diagnostic triad don't have anything per se to do directly with the neurobiology of autism. It's just the way the symptoms seemed to shake out amongst the people who were doing the definition of autism, the behavioral definition of autism. So if we zoom in on just one of those elements of the triad, social interaction, I think that when we characterize it, a certain theme begins to emerge, not of a deficit in any particular skill so much as a deficit in the coordination and integration of skills and the flexible application of skills in response to changing task demands. In a word, the deficit seems one of cognitive flexibility and in particular as applied to social situations, which are, of course, amongst the most demanding of cognitive problems. So in nonverbal communication, poor coordination of these multiple communication channels of gaze, expression, and gesture, a lack of manifest interest in others, lack of response to social overtures, lack of joining in social play, again, emphasis on the interactive application of social skills. Difficulties coordinating attention, so on and so forth. The theme here is all about coordination of social communicative and other cognitive skills in response to rapidly evolving social situations. And that theme of impaired flexibility is one that I want to emphasize and to come back to during this talk. So again, this pair of 2004 papers, the notion that we developed or enunciated is that local neural perturbed connectivity might be the root of autism. In other people's words, autism begins at the synapse. And then those local abnormalities in information representation may interact poorly with normal programs of emergent cognitive development to yield knock-on deficits. In particular, if you have an over-connected or an under-connected neural assembly, the ability to store information within that neural assembly, what an information theorist would call entropy, suffers. The analogy that I like to make is the notion of contrast on a whiteboard. If you have a marker that is completely dried out, if you have an ineffective set of synapses, an underconnected neural assembly, obviously you're not going to be able to generate contrast on that whiteboard. You're not going to be able to generate contrast between activated and inactivated units, and therefore your information capacity will suffer. Similarly, if you have an overconnected neural assembly, in the whiteboard analogy, if you have a very, very runny marker that smears all over the board the instant you touch it to the board surface, again, you're not going to be able to generate local contrast, and your information capacity will suffer. So in this picture, we sort of illustrated schematically what happens in that situation. The figure on the left is a set of neural assemblies in a typically developing brain. Figure on the right is what we believed at the time was happening in an autistic brain, and actually since has been borne out by a lot of empirical evidence on levels from the genetic and molecular to the neurophysiological and behavioral. In the left-hand picture, you have inputs leading to activated representations in delimited sets of neural units. and neural assemblies in different locations of the brain that are activated simultaneously by coordinated inputs develop in an activity-dependent manner long-range connections between them. So in the fully developed adult brain then, that is solving some cognitive problem, you have a wide array of brain regions all passing information between each other over these long-range connections. In the autistic brain, if activations in response to inputs from the sense organs or inputs from other brain areas, are noisy, if they are not well delimited. In other words, if you get a set of neural assemblies that amounts to everybody talking at the same time or nobody talking at the same time, then those activity-dependent, later emerging long-range connections between brain regions simply do not emerge. They don't know where to go. And as a result, long-range brain connectivity that ought to be developing during infancy and early childhood is derailed. The information processing structure that then develops within such a brain is one that makes virtue of necessity, that tries to do as much information processing within local brain regions as possible, and tries to avoid depending on these kinds of distributed networks. So here and here we have two pictures. This is from a 2003 paper contrasting autism and typically developing individuals on a visual perception task. And you can see the people with autism are just nailing visual cortex and not activating a widespread network, whereas the people without autism are shifting most of the computation into the network. That, in outline, is what we believe is going on within the autistic brain. And again, evidence in the 12 years since this pair of papers was published has tended to bear out that hypothesis. Well, this kind of disconnection has impact not only on brain structure and function, but on cognitive function, obviously, those being two sides of the same coin. So the question is, what kind of cognition do you develop if your mind is constrained to develop within such a functionally disconnected brain? My claim is that you develop a cognitive strategy that specializes in a single perceptual channel that emphasizes iconic rather than symbolic representation, and that both in spatial perceptual and social perceptual domains tends to be egocentric rather than allocentric. Both in terms of integrating multiple senses or multiple perceptual channels such as visual attention at different points in space into a single perceptual representation, and also in terms of referencing a referent to a symbol that stands for it, and also in terms of translating egocentric observations into allocentric representations, all of these tasks depend essentially on having an integrated and well-connected brain and mind in which individual brain regions and individual cognitive subsystems talk to each other flexibly and efficiently. So if you don't have that, this is the kind of cognitive style that you develop. One of the most, I think, telling observations of this kind of mental style that I've read is, this is back in 1994 when I was a graduate student and I actually had time to read internet email lists. There was at the time, I don't know if it still exists, there is an autism mailing list at St. John's University. There were a lot of professionals on it, and there were a lot of people with autism on it. And one of the people with autism wrote one day, talking about, you know, representation of other people and social perspective taking, he wrote, "It's just that putting myself in someone else's shoes means that I first have to force that person out of their own shoes." Now, he wasn't taking the notion of being in someone's shoes literally. You know, that wasn't the problem. But he was more expressing the fact that in order to take someone's social perspective, you actually do have to suppress your own perspective, and you have to be able to maintain those two contradictory views of the social world simultaneously and side by side. That imposes actually a huge cognitive load, and if you are the type of person who tends to give primacy to the perception, the iconic perception of things as they are, rather than to more symbolic percepts, then that is difficult for you. As Liz summarized, my first degree was, one of my majors was English literature, so I always like to relate this to this phenomenon to literary criticism. Jacques Lacan, whose psychiatric expertise is debatable, but whose literary expertise is was formidable, wrote in terms of this relationship between symbol and referent, le symbole se manifeste d'abord comme meurtre de la chose. The symbol manifests firstly as the killing of the thing. In other words, you have to suppress the thing in order really to wield the symbol. And if suppressing the thing is hard, then symbolic representation is hard. Various people have expressed this kind of difficulty of cognitive control that exists within people with autism. This is from Vasudha Prakash, who runs a very innovative school for children with autism in Chennai. She writes of thoughts housed in bodies and minds that may be fragmented, and that difference between thought and the bodily expression of thought is something that we'll get back to in the third part of this talk. So when you have this kind of impaired coordination of cognition, when you have this kind of impaired cognitive control, doing two things at the same time, performing two mental tasks at the same time, becomes actually very difficult. Knowing that something is true and imagining a counterfactual, that something else might be true, doing those at the same time is hard. Representation of oneself and one's own beliefs, desires, etc., and representation of another person and their beliefs and desires, etc., that's hard too. Thinking a thought and actually simultaneously trying to find the semantics and the syntax and the vocal tract movements that represent that thought. Perceiving something out there in the world, but also thinking and conceiving and imagining something in the abstract. That's hard too. The reality interferes with abstraction. And even, in fact, seeing and hearing something at the same time. There are people with autism, and Tito Mukhopadhyay has written about this in some of his autobiographical works, who simply have to grow to specialize in one particular sense or another. Tito grew to specialize in hearing, and he writes that if he wants to see a film, he has to pay for two tickets because he has to see the film twice in a row. First time, he listens to it. Next time, he watches it. Because can't switch and integrate. Other people, in fact, more people with autism than specialize in hearing, specialize in visual representation. A lot of you may have read some of the autobiographical works by Temple Grandin. She's a prime example and speaks very eloquently of her specializing in visual thinking. So all of these sort of competitions of simultaneous processes arise from a fundamental inability to integrate simultaneous processes with access to the central executive. You can do one thing at a time, and only one thing at a time. Well, I think a lot of scientists that talk about autism, rather ironically, share one of the difficulties that they attribute to autistic people. That is, getting lost in the details and not really seeing the centrally coherent picture. So this is my favorite mural at MIT. You can see what goes on when a couple of scientists try to study the elephant in the room. The levels of analysis at which their models are conceived are too detailed, and they fail to recognize the essential synthesis between their two sets of observations. Autism is a behaviorally defined syndrome. That makes it almost certain that at a biological level, it's an amalgam. We try almost by default as scientists to say, to zero in on the one mechanism and the one theory of autism. But asking really, at a fundamental level of analysis, what causes autism is about as dumb as asking, what causes cancer or what causes my car not to start. There are so many levels in which a biological system, or for that matter, a mechanical system, can be interfered with, that all produce in the end the same behavioral set of symptoms. So I've told you that we have theory and a lot of evidence suggesting that autism begins with local neural overconnectivity or underconnectivity, and then emergent disconnectivity at long ranges between brain regions. That is, in a way, a unifying principle, but when you get down into the nitty-gritty of it, there are many, many different factors, and likely combinations of factors, both genetic and environmental, that can skew synaptic connectivity. Alterations in cell number, alterations in how long a neuroprogenitor remains in the cell cycle during early brain development, alterations in number and strength of synapses, for example, differences in the postsynaptic protein PSD95, differences in neuromodulation. We all know, those of us who study autism, about the serotonin story in autism. Even immune differences. It turns out that immune molecules have a lot to do with the remodeling of synapses in the brain. So, some common properties, but a whole lot of different mechanisms. And those different mechanisms, those different routes into autism, lead correspondingly to a wealth of diversity within the autistic phenotype. You can hang a label on autism. You can say, okay, they satisfy these three elements of the diagnostic triad, therefore they are autistic. But there are so many differences between any two individuals with autism. There's a lot of fanning in from many separate combinations of individual biological antecedents. And correspondingly, there's a lot of fan out within the phenotype into different variations. Some people with autism are so severely affected that they cannot even speak. And some people with autism or autism spectrum conditions, the main problem is social interaction, and otherwise they lead very, very functional lives. An important point to notice when you conceive of this dependence of the behavioral syndrome of autism on biological causes that are somewhat distant from the final phenotype is that these categorical deficits, that is, the deficits in social communication and behavioral flexibility that result in the diagnostic label of autism, the deficits that are the most obvious, the most diagnostic, and the most debilitating are not necessarily the most primary in terms of causation. And, I might add, not necessarily even the most therapeutically accessible. In other words, if these emergent deficits arise from more subtle abnormalities earlier on during development, there is some potential that those early developmental antecedents might remain at least partially accessible to therapy, even later on in life. Those categorical deficits in autism also might arise from extremes of dimensional variation. So more and more, the more closely we look at the features that define autism, we find that these features are actually distributed continuously throughout the general population. And the science of autism, in a way, merges into the science of individual cognitive differences. Probably the best example of that is scores on the social responsiveness scale by John Constantino. This is a measure that looks at social communicative skills and impairments across the population. And it is one continuous distribution. If you go out into the tail of that distribution, you start finding people who carry an autism spectrum diagnosis. But it's not as if that diagnostic label constitutes a separate mode of the distribution. It's all on a continuum. So the corollary to that is that there really is no single explanation for autism at a fine-grained level of neurobiological detail. And therefore, there's not going to be any single best treatment. The way you deal with your autism depends on what got you into it and what the developmental and potentially the therapeutic antecedents were. And the maxim amongst professionals who care for and who teach people with autism is that if you've seen one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism. Generalization is very difficult. Okay, so that's a bit about the neurobiological background leading into this. Number two, social cognition, as I've sort of hinted at, is built in part from these domain-general cognitive skills. And social skills grow to co-vary with perceptual, attentional, and motor skills. This is especially true in the extreme case of developmental disorders, but it's also true in typical cognition. So here are some, I want to go briefly through some experiments that we've done, just illustrating that relationship between non-social domain-general cognitive skills and social cognitive impairments in autism. This is about as non-social as you can get, right? This is like I'm showing the fact that, actually I didn't give it to you in the bio, but I was Tony Movshin's visual neuroscience computer programmer for like a year and a half. And yeah, it shows. So it's about as non-social as you can get. We were asking people to identify a conjunction of spatial and chromatic orientation properties in this grid of distractors. And I won't go into the details of the task, but it's a visual attention task, and this is a very rapidly presented stimulus, so you can't do it with saccades. So we did this in a MRI scanner. We actually found that, quick quiz, red, pink, and blue. One of these is the people with autism. I've left them unlabeled here. One of these is the typical, and one of them is actually clinically unaffected siblings of people with autism. We put up the stimulus, flashed it up briefly, gave people 3 seconds to make their perceptual decision, and by that time they had to press a button, forced choice. So add in like 2 or 3 seconds for hemodynamic delay, and what we should see in a brain region whose activity is related to making this perceptual decision is a peak at about 5 or 6 seconds post-stimulus, right? So that's 2 or 3 seconds for hemodynamic delay plus 3 seconds of the decision period. These marks are 2 seconds each, so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, so on and so forth. Which one do you think is a typical individual? Just yell it out. I said yell.
Purple.
Yeah, okay, most people say red. It is, in fact, the red. Nice phasic activation, right? They turn it on, they get to about 5 or 6 seconds, they turn it off. Now the harder question. So, we've got autism and we've got clinically unaffected siblings of people with autism. Which one is the autistic trace? Yell it out.
Purple.
Yeah, everybody always says purple. Those are actually the siblings.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, isn't it? I being a sibling myself. They both have the same kind of delay. You know, by the time they actually fully activate, this is middle frontal gyrus. We see this pattern in a number of prefrontal areas. By the time they actually fully activate prefrontal cortex, dude, you know, game over, train has left the station. It's too late for that activation to be of any benefit in that perceptual decision. And yet, they kind of get stuck on it. They just can't let go. And so most of the activation comes far too late. The peak is way over here. We see the same kind of delay both in the autism individuals and in the SIBs. Now this is a contrast between a condition that is perceptually hard that involves a lot of distractors and a control condition that doesn't involve so many distractors. And we actually find if we look at individuals' peak times that peak time, the delay in that maximum hemodynamic blood oxygenation response, actually correlates with measures of social communicative impairment. That's not only true in the autism sample, it's also true in the siblings, and even slightly true in the typical controls. So again, you know, you couldn't get more non-social with a task, right? I mean, there's nothing social about this. And yet, social cognitive psychometric measures correlate with the pattern of blood oxygenation response, the timing of blood oxygenation response in autistic individuals and their SIBs, and even slightly in the typically developing sample. So there's got to be something going on there where some general mechanism of cognitive control is somehow contributing to social communicative function. Okay, so here's another example. A while ago, when I was at Cornell, we coded up these experimental paradigms into some video games, and all the data are automatically logged. We have a log file analyzer that goes through these things and gives us the data. So here is here's some data from people playing one of the games whilst they've been wired up for EEG. And these are data coming out of a go-no-go task. In fact, this is a scene from the aforementioned task. You've got a spaceship that materializes out of a wormhole, and you have to decide, it's either an enemy spaceship or a friendly one, and you have to decide whether to shoot it, right? So it's a very straightforward go-no-go task. If it's an enemy, you go, you shoot it. If it's a friend, you inhibit. You avoid shooting it. All right. In this graph, you have the P3 response. In people with autism, they're clinically unaffected siblings and typical individuals. The P3 response to that no-go stimulus, okay? And here are the graphs. Graphs are the means. These means are actually all statistically different from each other. The P3 response to the no-go stimulus is highest in people with autism, lowest in typically developing individuals, and in between in the SIBs, and all those differences are statistically significant. We can take these peak heights, measure them. Imagine passing a vertical bar here measuring up to the height of the peak. Okay, take that measurement, peel it off this graph, stick it on this graph. So again, this vertical axis is P3 response peak amplitude, and this axis is the score on a measure of social cognition, Simon Baron Cohen's reading the mind in the eyes test. The correlation is significant. I'm sorry I didn't actually label it with a figure on this slide. I should have done. But it is a statistically significant correlation, or rather robustly so. Interestingly, this correlation arises from a combination of all of the groups, the siblings and the typical individuals and the autistic individuals. They're color-coded in this scatter plot. And the correlation between P3 amplitude and reading the mind and the eyes test score is actually significant. That correlation arising not just from one group, but from all the groups, variation in all the groups when you put them together. So again, it really suggests that there's something going on here, some relationship between the social perceptual or social cognitive skills measured by the reading the mind and the eyes test and the non-social brain electrical response to a simple go-no-go stimulus. Okay, so here's another one. This is another video game. This is an analog of the Posner visual spatial shift attention task. And in the context of this game, we recorded responses to the distracting task irrelevant stimuli. So in a way, that previous graph of the P3 was a task irrelevant stimulus. It was a no-go stimulus. You didn't have to do anything in response to it but inhibit. So here we've got brain electrical responses to distracting stimuli in a Posner task. So you have targets, both cued and uncued targets in a Posner task. And then we also mix those in with distractor stimuli that demand no response. So typically developing individuals' response to peripheral distractors is much lower than the response to peripheral targets. You can see, typical P3 and slow wave pattern. Then we look at the people with autism. Well, their responses to distractors and targets don't really differ much during the beginning of the epic. But then round here, round about, 500-600 milliseconds, something interesting begins to happen. If we can read sort of brain electrical voltage as some kind of proxy for activation, it seems like the people with autism, again, get stuck on a stimulus. They latch onto it. In the case of these peripheral distractors, they just won't let go, even though the distractors are completely irrelevant to the task at hand. And then when we look at siblings, well, in one way, the siblings are kind of halfway, as is so often the case, between the typical and the autistic populations. If you look at the beginning of the epoch here, again, around about 500 milliseconds, they seem to be developing a P3 response that is in between the two groups. But then if you look farther out in the epoch, you see the same prolonged activation, the same getting stuck on the distractor in the sibling group as you see in the autism group. So again, it seems like something is really happening in the way in which the autistic brain responds to task-irrelevant stimuli and gets stuck on those task-irrelevant stimuli, being unable to cognitively shift away from them. Okay, so that's a bit about autistic perception, and all right, I'm going to finish up fairly rapidly. We also study motor capabilities in children with autism, and this is work in collaboration with the Calm Deal Clinic in Bangalore. This is all 31 of the children that they enrolled in 1 year in the clinic. I won't go into the details of the clinical program there because we just don't have time. But we looked using some indigenously developed tests in India, which has since been normed against some standard tests, the VMPAC and the Mullen. We looked at patterns of motor and communicative skills in these individuals. So we looked at gross motor skill, fine motor, oral motor, receptive and expressive language. And to make a long story short, what we found is exemplified in the difference between the pink traces here and the traces in various shades of blue. we can actually subdivide the whole group of children into about a third of them who fall into a motor impaired classification, and another two-thirds who were more motor intact. If you look at the pink traces here, they do a very good job at contrasting oral motor skill from gross and fine motor skill, and associating that oral motor deficit with a difference between expressive and receptive language measures. So in about a third of the sample, there is this curious pattern where you see this big dip in oral motor skills, and that comes combined with a disparity between expressive and receptive skills, receptive being largely intact, but expressive skill taking a hit. What that suggests to us, of course, is that in that one-third of autistic children who lack communicative speech, let me speak clearly, take the set of all children who lack communicative speech in autism, one-third of those fall into this motor-impaired pattern where the disparity between expressive and receptive language seems as though it might be being driven by a deficit in oral motor control rather than any kind of cognitive deficit primarily. Well, the motor impaired group, they start with a disadvantage, they end with a disadvantage, they end the year of treatment with lesser oral motor scores, and they also end with less change in receptive language scores. So they start low and they stay low. Well, on the basis of this and some other work, my student Jeff Valla, former student Jeff Valla, and I defined a new triad of autistic impairments, which can be described as impairments in cognitive and motor control, number one, sensory perceptual organization, number two, and also in social skills and social motivation and reward. Each one of those three domains of a new kind of triad interacts with each other and reinforces each other. Well, if all of this is true, if perceptual and cognitive and motor skills that are domain general can interact with each other to affect the development of social cognition, then that opens the door to a kind of backdoor approach to therapy, one that might elicit social cognitive benefits by focusing on developing prerequisite domain general cognitive skills. All right, so last thing, therapeutic imperatives. This is the way not to do it. This is very much a therapist-centered rather than a child-centered view. Clearly, you know, this dude has an agenda and is forcing it on this poor child. There are, of course, more humane ways to do this. And one of them is figuring out what the child is interested in. This child happens to be interested in the string, and he has discovered a very interesting parametric relationship between the deflection that he gives to his wrist and the visual angle through which the string passes. Nobody has told him to do this. He's discovered it all on his own. And this is an extremely teachable moment if the person behind the camera would get out from behind the camera and go and join in this activity and experiment with the child. Because this is basically, he's learning how to do science. Unfortunately, moments like this tend not to be recognized because they're not what we would expect socially of an individual. We want him to be playing with the toys, we want him to be making eye contact with the person behind the camera, so on and so forth. So unfortunately, a lot of these moments go without being taken advantage of. When you do take advantage of them, they can become the sort of fulcrum for developing social interactions. Well, many methods of social communicative therapy for autism work by slowing down communication and or by reducing the demand for rapid integration or synchrony. And if you think of picture exchange, you know, where you can asynchronously take a picture and hand it to somebody, signing, especially in terms of single nouns and or single verbs, sequential pointing and typing at symbols, and also, of course, discrete trials paradigms where you can repeat the trial from the word go and until the outcome is the way you want it. All of these methods make it unnecessary, or at least less necessary, to focus simultaneously on the thought and the communicative act. And that's important when cognitive control and cognitive load are a problem for you. All right, well, we've studied one communication method, which actually was developed initially at the Communication Deal Clinic in Bangalore. It was popularized and actually kind of skewed in a not very productive way later on by somebody called Soma Mukhopadhyay, Tito's mother, who runs a for-profit clinic called Halo. But the root of it comes from Communication Deal in India. The most famous user of this communication technique probably is Tito himself, who has written several books. And it begins with what we might call basically two alternative force choice. This is Soma, who has popularized the therapy. She goes up to a child, and number one, she makes sure to co-localize the communicative content with the most perceptually, physically salient stimulus in the room. Now, right now, to all of you, I'm the most salient stimulus here because you are privileging the input that's coming from me because it's input of a social character. It's social communicative. I'm looking at you. I'm talking at you. I become the most salient. But if you don't have that social privilege, then maybe the most salient stimulus in this room, simply in terms of physical salience, might be the motes of dust in the projector light, or the hum of one of those fluorescents back there, or what have you. If you can become the most physically salient stimulus, not just the most socially salient stimulus, then you can capture the attention of a person with autism and maintain that attention. And if they can attend to only one thing, it's going to be whatever involuntarily captures their attention. So what she does, she comes up to the person. Often she will tear paper. She's torn these two pieces apart. She's offering this person a two alternative force choice. He has to point to one response or another. Both of these responses are copied out on these two pieces of paper. Well, she builds up from that two alternative force choice. Again, getting the stimulus directly in the person's face, not allowing other more physically salient stimuli to interfere. She builds up from that into 26 alternative force choice in which individuals can point sequentially at letters of the alphabet. This is all done initially in an errorless learning format where the correct response is supported if the person is not doing it initially. Right. Well, we studied, these were my undergraduates, Grace Chen and Keith Yoder at Cornell. We studied a little bit about what might be going on during this putative communication method. I say putative because we explicitly have not worked on verifying it. But what we did look at is overt attentional engagement. You know, is the person with autism either looking at the conversational partner or looking at an object of mutual reference? That counts as engaged attention. Or are they looking off somewhere else into space? What we found out is that there's an inverse relationship between overt attentional engagement and verifiable success of the communication. If they give a correct answer to a question, it's likely that they're looking off into space. They tend to be incorrect when they're actually overtly engaging. We believe that that's a compensatory strategy because, you know, it's something we all do. If you ask me a hard question and I'm looking right at you, I'm going to say, well, let me think about that for a moment. And I'm going to disengage to manage my cognitive load. I'm going to think. Then I'm going to reengage and reestablish eye contact and give my answer. The only difference with people with autism is that they have such an issue with cognitive load that they have to do this all the time. It's normal behavior. It's just occurring in an abnormal context. Well, so that leads me to the final element of this talk. What might we do to help motor impaired individuals with autism to more efficiently communicate? We actually had developed software for the iPad, which I have right here. I can show to you after the talk, that tries to train up the motor ability to point at objects on a touchscreen, and then bootstrap from that pointing ability, that iconic pointing ability, to a more symbolic pointing at letters of the alphabet. And finally, we have a mode where for those people who do have some oral motor control, they can practice speaking. So in point mode, I'll skip the bit about the design process. I can tell you about this later if you want. But in point mode, it's really nothing more than a jigsaw puzzle. We segment an object into several pieces, and we train people on the motor skill of isolating a finger and dragging that piece across the screen. We've made some modifications to the user interface to accommodate for the autistic style of open loop motor control. We bootstrap up from that to type mode, where each piece is, instead of moving the piece directly, each piece is labeled with a letter of the alphabet, and you must press that corresponding letter on the keyboard. Invariably, people with autism, when they're using this, they at first perseverate on the iconic mode of reference, where they will try to move the piece itself. We have features built into the software that will try to shift attention from the piece to the corresponding letter. So a line appears to the letter and drags attention from the piece to the more salient letter on the keyboard. And lastly, we have a speak mode, which obviously I don't have a picture of because it's all audio, but we have a mode in which we've integrated free software called Open Ears into the program, and it can it both models and prompts speaking of individual syllables of the word, and then finally the whole word. So let me very, very quickly give you some video examples. All of this is trained up in an errorless learning format, right? So you're going to see a lot of, in this first video, you're going to see a lot of guidance.
What are you listening to? Very good. Yes, next piece. Let's finish it. Come on. Come, let's try it together. This piece goes here.
So sometimes he or she is succeeding, sometimes not so much, and you can see that right now he's a bit unstable and he's got to have the hand over hand.
Which one next?
Now he's doing it on his own.
Go on, next.
Okay, I'll skip the rest of that in the interest of time.
Very good.
If I can get out of this.
Very good.
Okay. I'll just play you one more, and then that's the end. Okay. This, by contrast, is a typically developing child with the same software. It's also fun for typical children. Okay, and lastly, what do we have here? Yeah, it's the last one I'll play.
Yes.
This is after some more progress has been made.
Let's do kick first. Let's type.
So this is now the type mode. The child has done okay on the pointing mode. And now the therapist is modeling for him how he should be using the type mode. When he tries the iconic referencing style, you see that the key on the keyboard becomes highlighted, trying to involuntarily draw his attention to it. So again, she's modeling that for him in an errorless learning format.
O. Good. O. Where's O?
and he's beginning to get it.
Balloon. Let's try next one.
Okay, I'll stop that there in the interest of time. Okay. So, that's where we are with that software right now. And I've lost my mouse cursor, unfortunately. Which always happens. I have to sleep the thing and get it back. Here we go. There we go. Where's slideshow? Okay. So in the future work, we want to refine the software with more user involvement. I should say it logs absolutely every contact with the touchscreen, and perhaps more importantly, every motion of the device. So we can tell whether the therapist is moving the screen or whether the individual is moving their hand to the screen. We're moving towards a pilot randomized controlled trial of this, that's where we are. What curing autism means to us, I always end with this slide, is to give people the communicative abilities to share their unique insights with the rest of the social world. People with autism have a lot to share, that differs from the way you and I see the world. And we do not at all want to delete those insights. Rather, we want to make them accessible to other people. So all of this work is dependent, obviously, not just on me, but also on my old team at Cornell, my new team at NTU, and on various collaborators across the globe. This is Pratibha Karant and her team at the Comdeal Center. Manoj Dhariwal from Mad Rat Games in Bangalore, who developed the initial version of the software. Marla Tini and Marissa Westerfield at San Diego, who were involved in some of the EEG analyses. And my collaborator Nandini Singh and her team at the National Brain Research Center in Manesar, just outside of Delhi. So that's it. I'm sorry I've run a bit long, but thank you very much for listening.
Great, thank you very much. That was really, really interesting. So we've got maybe time for one or two very quick questions.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. And then obviously we're going to take it upstairs for lunch, so there'll be opportunity then to ask any other questions and also to see the iPad software if you would like. So does anyone have a few questions for now? Yeah, Danielle.
I found your individual differences approach fascinating, and the idea that this is, you know, we need to think about these things dimensionally. And that's the approach we've been taking to children's social communication in typical development. So I really believe that that's got to be the right approach, to see these things dimensionally, take an individual difference as approach. But when you do that, for every one thing that correlates, there's another thing that surprisingly doesn't. And mm-hmm. I keep on thinking that ultimately what we'd really, really like for pragmatic development is a very, very large data set of lots of different measures of social cognition, lots of different measures of cognition. And the idea would be to make a multidimensional space where you'd find little attractors where children would tend to sit. But that seems quite difficult to get off the ground, and I'm not sure. Sometimes I have total faith in that approach, and sometimes I think, exactly how is this going to work and tell us what's going on? I switch between thinking this is going to be brilliant and thinking, despairing. So I wondered what your take on that was.
Well, I do think that technology is going to catch up with that idea. Yeah, and we already see the first glimmerings of it. Are you familiar with Deb Roy's work at the MIT Media Lab?
Yeah.
So I mean, that stuff is just really cool. You know, I mean, obviously, you right now to do what he has done, you have to have your house wired up, and you have to have one of those special lamps with a hard disk in it, and all that stuff. But that's coming, especially because there's commercial value in that. You know, not just research, but you know, there's a market, and you know, everybody wants their child to be the best. You know, so I do think that technology is going to come on the scene, perhaps driven more by commercial interests than by us researchers. And once it does come on the scene, I mean, everything's going to be wired up. It's going to be pretty easy to get the data, and then we will have that big data space.
But it seems like the problem is analytical, like, so building the model, so you want to be able to identify some latent variables that are explaining variance in subsets of tasks that and other ones that explain. So for example, you take like emotion recognition, and for some reason that doesn't necessarily correlate with visual perspective taking, which also doesn't correlate with social perspective taking, which doesn't necessarily correlate with narrative ability, which doesn't necessarily correlate, but then these things, components of those will correlate with vocabulary ability, which will also match up with some of the things you've been talking about.
And then, of course, you also have to ask when these correlations are being done, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what is the ultimate goal? I guess what I'm asking is, what is the ultimate goal of this? Analytically, like, what kind of statistical model would we build of this?
No pressure with that question.
Yeah, no.
And I know Liz is interested in this question too, and so am I. I asked Jenny because I would love to know the answer, and I don't.
Well, obviously, I don't know the answer either. But I mean, we can only model the data that we're currently able to collect, which is, of course, a tiny fraction of what is out there. That tiny fraction will become much, much greater within the next, 10, 15 years. I wish I had a good answer for you, but the finding the answer, it is going to depend on big data, like you say, and it's also going to depend upon having a big sample that can be fractionated, principally by age and developmental stage, and also undoubtedly by a number of other variables.
Maybe we could talk about that.
Yeah,
something I think is also a way that we conceptualize these things. I think we have very fixed definitions of social cognition.
Yes,
And my experience in data that I've looked at is that those definitions that we have don't necessarily represent what's going on in the data, and that they're very kind of top-down definitions that don't match the reality.
Well, I mean, you look at the behavioral definition of autism.
Exactly.
That's just wacky.
So I really like to have new triads, which is, I suppose that would be the ultimate outcome of these things, wouldn't it? It would be to say, okay, on first glance, we've pigeonholed people because of this triad, but actually that wasn't quite so helpful, and now we've got some different categorizations which we could have quicker diagnostic group subgrouping, and then different therapeutic approaches that would work for different subgroups.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously the human goal of all this is, how do you match the right therapeutic and pedagogic methods to the right people?
Right.
And that goal exists not only in developmentally disordered populations, but in the general population.
Yeah.
Different teaching methods are applicable to different children.
Yeah.
That actually also is an axis of marketability, isn't it?
Right.
Okay, I suspect that other people will have places to be at 1 o'clock. So those of you who don't and want to join us for lunch, we're going to go upstairs. Well, we can carry on with questions.
I'm very sorry to have run over that much.
That's worth it.